Yes.
I'm sorry. Last time, I had a question about something you mentioned last time that I didn't fully understand.
Go ahead.
You mentioned there was civil war after Jonathan took both high priests and absolute monarchy. And I wasn't sure exactly to what extent there was actual bloodshed or war between Jew and Jew.
Well, as punishment for this treason by the Pharisees, I think, according to Josephus, Jonathan Alexander crucified several thousand of them. So there was a fair amount of bloodshed, even in a couple of pitched battles. But Jonathan realized that the Seleucids really put all their muscle to bear. He couldn't possibly win. And so he saw it was more advantageous just to make a compromise towards the end. And something that also encouraged the Pharisees is that, again, you know, the idea that this compromise of splitting the high priesthood and the civil rulership would take place. And they felt that having gone through this experience, that it was less likely that one of the sons would refuse to go along with it, because they had seen what the temper of the people was, that if a push came to shove, they would resort to military means, even if it meant giving up the independence of the country. So they thought that this time the compromise would work. Okay, I'd like to give you, well, I will in a few minutes, a sort of dynastic chart showing the rest of the Hasmonean dynasty, because things get a bit complicated in this next period. And rather than having you take down in great detail all the information about everything that happened in this period, I'd like you to focus on a few major themes that you should be aware of, the general developments. And then, of course, you should know something about the leading personalities, the significance that each of them had for this time period. Now, the things you should keep in mind are the decline of the Hasmonean family, because by the time we end today, we will find that the rulership passes to somebody who is not of their family, who is not ethnically, at least, a Jew, although religiously he was. And of course, I'm referring to the man we know in history as Herod the Great. So what we're going to do now is sort of trace the general developments from the time of, let's say, the close of Jonathan Alexander's reign down to the emergence of Herod the Great. I'm actually trying to condense into two lectures to create a space so I can get back and do that Darius the Mede thing. The second thing we're going to see in this period of time is the steady rise in influence and power of the family of Herod the Great. Because Herod the Great was not the first of his family to exercise major power in Judea. His father was the real architect of the family's rise in influence. And the third thing we want to be considering today is getting an appreciation for the steady increase in Rome, in the Roman presence in Judea. Because this also takes place in this period of time from the close of Jonathan Alexander's reign in 76 BC until Herod takes over in 37. Now, let me at this point give out the genealogical chart that reflects the last remaining Hasmonean rulers. Jonathan Alexander managed to reign or rule, whatever way you want to call it, for about 4 years after the end of the Civil War. The Civil War came to an end in 80 BC. And upon his death, there was a division in the rulership, but not exactly as he had provided for by agreement with his enemies, the Pharisees. But what happened is the civil leadership passed to his wife. The civil leadership passed to his wife, who ruled the nation with the title of queen. And his oldest son, Hyrcanus, became the high priest. And of course, according to the terms of his agreement, It was expected that when Salome Alexandra, his wife, died, then his younger son would become the civil leader with the title of ethnarch. Now, we need to understand something about these different personalities. First of all, Salome Alexandra was maybe not exceptional as an individual, but she came from a Pharisaic family. And indeed, her brother was the leader of the Pharisaic party. And so when she became the civil ruler, you can imagine the Pharisees began to enjoy a great deal of influence in the direction in terms of the policies of the state. And a good deal of the Hellenization, the overt Hellenization, was sort of reversed. But what we need to focus on are these two key figures, Hyrcanus II and Aristobulus II. And you'll notice there's a whole bunch of dates under Hyrcanus II, because this tells you this was a very complicated period with its ups and downs and reversals. Hyrcanus II, while the older son, was a weak, vacillating type of individual, a weak-willed and sort of vacillating type of individual. Aristobulus was a very shrewd, very dynamic, very intelligent individual. So there's quite a contrast between these brothers. Now, Hyrcanus, because he recognized his weaknesses — some people are smart enough at least to recognize their weaknesses and do something about it to try to improve on them — knew that he was really no match for his much more talented brother. And so he hired himself a, you might say, full-time manager, campaign manager, if we were to update it to 20th century American terms. And this individual is the father of the man that we know as Herod the Great. His name was Herod Antipater. Now, in this family of the Herods, it is very easy to get lost, because almost all of the males of the family were called Herod. Now, you may be aware, of course, of Herod the Great, and then, of course, Herod Antipas, who was the Tetrarch of Galilee at the time of Jesus' ministry, and is the one who executed Jesus. If so, you can give yourself a mark of congratulations, because many of our students don't realize there's a difference between Herod the Great, who was the king when Jesus was born, and Herod Antipas, who ruled Galilee and executed John the Baptist. But there were a lot of other Herods as well. Maybe one, two, three, four, five others at least, six others at least in this general time period, simply because they like naming all their sons Herod. And so in order to keep them straight, we generally use their secondary names, or we use their name Herod with some qualifier after it, like Herod Antipater or Herod Antipas, so we can tell the Herods apart. So Herod Antipater is the father of Herod the Great. And he was a political genius, a power broker of no mean ability. And I think you will come to understand why I give him such testimonial very shortly as we discuss some of the events of this time period. Now that you all have the chart in front of you, you can see that when Salome Alexandra died in 67, something happened. Because while she was ruling, you'll notice Hyrcanus was the high priest. He was the high priest and she was the civil ruler. There had to be a separation, because obviously she couldn't be the high priest. That would have been a bit too much for the population to swallow. But when she died in 67, what seems to have happened? Can you piece this together just by looking at the dates? What seems to have happened upon her death? Art? And can you put them in the proper order? Can you reconstruct the order of events just from the dates? That immediately upon the death of Alexandra, what happens here? Mike?
Well, it looks like Hyrcanus was ascribed to the kingship. And then Herod Antipater was ascribed to the kingship.
Yeah. In other words, that attempt at compromise again did not work. That Hyrcanus, upon the death of his mother, decided that just being high priest would not be sufficient, and he would not allow his brother to have the office. And so he announced upon his mother's death that he would continue, of course, as high priest, but he would now be the civil ruler also, and he would style himself as king of Judea. And obviously this didn't sit too well with Aristobulus, who thought he'd been cheated of his inheritance that had been guaranteed by, you might say, political compact between his father and the Pharisaic leadership. And being, of course, aided by the Pharisees, who, of course, felt betrayed again, to some degree he was aided by them, he managed to seize power. And he ruled as both high priest and king from 67 to 63. Now you might say, well, why would the Pharisees assist him in this? Because, you know, after all, they're back to square one again. But remember, since the days of Salome Alexandra, the Pharisees had had a decisive voice in the direction of policies of the state. They had greatly reduced the Hellenization that existed in Judea. They didn't feel quite as threatened any longer. And because Aristobulus allowed himself to be guided very heavily by the Pharisees, as far as, you know, before instituting any new policies, how does this sit with the Pharisees? And what do they think about how well this sits with Jewish law? You know, they weren't so offended any longer about this hole in the wall of separation. They didn't feel they were about to be inundated by Hellenization. And so they were willing to go along with this one man in charge arrangement. Now, you'll notice that there is a reversal again in 63. Aristobulus loses both positions, and Hyrcanus gets it back, but with a slight difference. What's the slight difference that happens in 63? It's just not a matter of taking it back only from Aristobulus, but there's a small change, and it maybe looks subtle, but there's something behind it. Kippy? Yeah. And therein lies a very interesting story of human nature and political intrigue, which will help you to appreciate the skills of Herod Antipater. In order to understand what was going on, the year 63 BC was a crucial year for this area of the world. And it revolves around the activities of the Roman general Pompey. Now, Pompey was one of a series of generals in the Roman state that had a very large army of fiercely loyal soldiers and officers, and was viewed, therefore, by the Senate of Rome as a very strong political threat to their hold on control of power. Now, they were afraid to resort to something as crass as political assassination. And so they devised something else that they thought would get him out of harm's way and not reflect badly on them. At this particular time in the Eastern Mediterranean, the Eastern Mediterranean was being threatened by pirates and also by a very ambitious ruler in Asia Minor. And they said, well, we'll just send Pompey on this mission to take care of the pirates, clear the Eastern Mediterranean Sea of pirates. And since these are very elusive characters, that should keep him busy for a good number of years and out of our hair for that period of time. And if anything else, if he should perhaps more speedily than we intend take care of that problem, he can take care of this upstart ruler in Asia Minor who seems to be threatening to follow an independent policy instead of towing the Roman line. Well, much to their horror and surprise, or maybe the reverse, surprise and horror, Pompey rapidly dispatched the pirates and just as rapidly took care of this problem of this upstart king in Asia Minor. But not content to return home at that particular juncture, Pompey, following up on this tremendous victory, and here we need a map of the Middle East again, one of my specialities, I guess we put Cyprus in there, is we have this was already Roman, well, I don't know. This is Europe. I guess I shouldn't leave Greece out. It's in there somewhere. The Black Sea is there. I guess we should tie this together. Yeah. Okay. We've got Judea here. We've got Syria here. Egypt, of course, down here. And in this part of Asia Minor, there were a fairly large number of different independent entities. And what Pompey began doing was sort of making a triumphal tour through this entire area and deciding the political fate of each of these nations. Now you might say, well, how did he get the right to do that? Well, he had enough troops behind him that they very well couldn't argue with his decisions. And after this tremendous victory in the East, at least he was very popular by many of the people that lived there, because being commercially minded people, their trade had been gravely threatened by the pirates, you see, and he'd taken care of that menace for them. And so the ruling classes couldn't very well object if he decided to dispose of political arrangements as he saw fit. And basically he followed this policy. As he would enter a country, he would classify it as belonging to one of three categories. If it was a strong, stable country, he would simply sign a treaty of alliance on behalf of Rome and this country. Now, you have to remember, he was acting totally on his own hook without any authority from the Senate to do these things. Though it was legal what he was doing, because the Romans, because of their way they tended to do things, when they sent a general out, they never knew exactly how much might be involved in his task. And so they tried to give him an area, sort of a general authorization that was as broad as possible. So if he needed to do something to secure the main objective, he didn't have to contact home and say, am I allowed to do this? You see. Very different from the way we run our system, where our generals, you know, have to be contacting the president if they want to use certain methods, because the president would have to authorize them to do this or that or the next thing. And so what his grant of authority was Asia. In other words, anything that he needed to do in Asia to accomplish his main objective, he was allowed to do. That's the way they tended to do things. And so using this cover of this broad authorization, he was now going about this area and, you know, you might say creating foreign policy on his own. So if a state fell into this category of being strong and stable, he signed a treaty of alliance with this particular state. Of course, on recognition that Rome was a power in the area, and this state, although remaining autonomous, agreed not to do anything to offend Roman objectives. Now, if a state was not strong and stable, but was sort of well, let's go to the category three. It'll become clearer what category two is in a minute if we do three first. Under category three, we have a weak state, a weak, unstable state. Then this territory probably, because of its weakness and its instability, would be an open invitation to its neighbors, you know, for conquest. And that's something Rome wasn't interested in. Because if you have a weak, unstable state, and several other countries decide to try to take it over, and then they squabble among themselves about the spoils, the distribution of the spoils, you're going to create instability in the entire area. And this is the one thing Romans didn't like. Instability. They didn't like chaos. They wanted order, permanence, stability. That was what they were trying to bring to all these areas. Because they had seen too often in the past that when squabbles broke out among these, you know, junior league members of the area, of the community of nations, Rome was inevitably brought in to settle the squabble, and Rome just didn't like to be bothered with these brush fire wars. So if a nation was weak and unstable, he simply annexed it, making it a Roman province. In other words, under direct Roman rule, if it was a weak, unstable society. That way, if the Romans planted their foot firmly in that place, all the other people would keep out, and stability would be maintained. Now, in the second category, you have those that sort of fell in between the strong, stable states and the weak, unstable states. They had elements of instability and elements of stability. In other words, it was sort of a mixed bag. But with a little bit of banging of heads together, perhaps, some suitable arrangement could be made where strength could be created in that state. And therefore, the Romans would not have to directly take it over, and then it could then approach Category 1. So there were, it was sort of a mixed situation in Category 2. But with Roman, arbitration, put it that way, with Roman arbitration could become a strong, stable state, and therefore a Roman ally. So Pompey was on this swing through the Near East, making these decisions. Some areas he annexed outright as Roman provinces, others he made Roman allies. Sometimes he arbitrated between competing political leaders, saying, okay, I award this control of the country to this person, he is in charge, you shut up and don't cause problems. He is now an ally of Rome. Now, why should the disaffected party who loses this arbitration accept the Roman decision? Very simple. The winner becomes a Roman ally. If he makes trouble for the winner, Rome will bring in all their troops and smash him. And so the losers usually slinked off into the sunset with their tail between their legs. He got to Syria, which was still in its traditional mess, with the two branches of the royal family squabbling over who's going to control Syria. And this is all that essentially was left of the Seleucid Empire, Syria. It had shrunk down to just that by 63 BC from its former greatness. And Pompey assessed the situation. He says, this is definitely a Category 3 situation. There's no hope of revitalizing any strength here. And therefore, he just made it a Roman province. After he had taken care of the matter of Syria, his attentions began to turn towards Judea. Because in Judea, Hyrcanus had just launched, you might say, a struggle to recover his control from Aristobulus. And so the two of them were squaring off again in the year 63. And so both of them were led to understand that, you know, if they didn't patch up their quarrels, what were they asking for, given the example of Syria? If they were perceived to be a state like Syria, they'd both lose out, and Judea would just become a Roman province. So they had to at least put a face of harmony on their squabble. Otherwise, they would certainly be taken over. And so both of them trooped up to Damascus and sat down with Pompey and said, please decide the issue. You know, we'll go with your decision. Whoever you choose here to be the leader will be the leader. And Pompey, you know, met first with one, discussed things, met then with the other. And being the shrewd man that he was, Pompey rapidly sized up Hyrcanus for what he was, and he rapidly sized up Aristobulus for what he was. Now, which do you think he would favor in making his decision, Barat?
Well, he would favor Hyrcanus for two reasons. First, because he showed himself as the king. The main reason being that he'd be
Did you study these three things carefully? I think you presume too much from the chart. Therein lies an interesting story. Remember, we have to get to this Herod Antipater character. You haven't yet seen his fine hand in all these things, Dave. Yes, except that Rome never wanted to control territory it didn't have to. This is the thing that always lay behind their policy. This is why, as I say, the strong, stable ones he made allies, and those that were not were sort of mixed. If they wanted just to grab territory, the mixed situations, they would have just taken over. But in the mixed situations, what did they do? They wanted them to become strong so that they could become independent allies without Rome being burdened with the necessity of controlling them. I mean, Rome realized their resources were not inexhaustible. They couldn't spread themselves so thin. And so they tended to look, Pompey looked at Judea sort of as this kind of a situation. And he's trying to make it strong, stable, especially since the border of, you might say, the area of Roman influence was right there, and what lay on the other side of the border in this period of time. Anybody know your general history enough? The Parthian Empire, which was, as by this time, maybe not as large as the Roman, but almost as powerful. And therefore, Pompey wanted to strengthen this border region, because this is the thing that's hard up against the Parthian Empire. He would much prefer a strong border. So that's why he took over Syria, because the Syrians were too weak to become strong. It would be an open invitation for the Parthians to invade, you see. By taking it over and planting Roman troops there, he guaranteed the security of that part of the border. In the case of Judea, you had at least a promising individual in Aristobulus who could be counted on to make Judea strong and therefore preserve the border against Parthian invasion. And so here's where the genius of Herod Antipater came in. Herod Antipater began to sense that Pompey was about to choose Aristobulus. And he goes to see Pompey, and he says, I understand, I am presuming that this is what you're going to announce. And frankly, I couldn't blame you, because I know Hyrcanus. I've been sort of his advisor for many years, and he's just not really the man for the job, you know, that you would prefer. And Aristobulus really has a lot more talents and abilities, and I don't blame you for being about to make this decision. But I know that most of all you're interested in stability in this area. And Hyrcanus is maybe weak and he may be vacillating, but he's a proud man. And proud men may be weak, but they can sometimes cause a lot of trouble if they're not handled delicately. So may I make a suggestion to you? That before you announce that you've chosen Aristobulus, why don't you call in Hyrcanus and, you know, have him as a guest of honor at a banquet. Treat him nicely, stroke him, you know, and then sort of break it to him gently that though while you find many admirable qualities in him, that the needs of Rome would be best served if his brother was chosen. So it's not like he just gets the announcement cold in a public setting. He feels humiliated and embarrassed, shocked, and so on, and he then may feel called upon to defend his vanity. This way, if you let him down easy, I promise to work with him and help him to accept your decision, and you won't have any problems here with Judea. Well, this made sense to Pompey, but he was simply being manipulated, you see, by Herod Antipater. Because as soon as the invitation was issued to the banquet, and Hyrcanus went off alone to the banquet with Pompey, Antipater made sure that the news was leaked to Aristobulus. Did you know that your brother was summoned to a banquet of honor with Pompey? And, you know, and he didn't do it directly, because obviously if he approached Aristobulus directly, Aristobulus would smell something fishy about the situation. But he sort of had one of his associates consort with one of the associates of Aristobulus and sort of leak this information, you know, as planned, and that got carried back to Aristobulus. And Aristobulus drew, as Antipater intended, the wrong impression from the invitation. The impression being, he's going to choose my brother! And he's invited him to a banquet, and he's honoring him, and he's telling him probably right now that he's his choice. And Aristobulus may have been very shrewd and dynamic and intelligent, but he was also a hothead. Which is what Antipater counted on, see. And so he stormed out of Damascus back to Judea, raised the troops, you know, say, and fortified, you know, closed the gates of Jerusalem, was prepared to hang out and fight for his kingdom. You see. Now, at this juncture, Pompey had no choice. You see, with a rebellious Aristobulus, you know, he couldn't very well work with such a character. And so Pompey gathered his forces and marched on Jerusalem and conquered Jerusalem. According to Josephus, he was so curious about the Holy of Holies in the temple that he actually entered it because he was very curious what was in it. You know, since the Jews had this God that had no image, well, he was wondering what is in there. He was told, well, nothing. Because, of course, the only thing that had been there anciently in the Holy of Holies had been the Ark, and the Ark was no longer around, and so nothing was there. And he couldn't believe that in the Holy of Holies nothing would be there. And he believed that fabulous treasures were stored there, and he wanted to see this for himself, and he walked in. It was empty. Much surprise. Anyway, Aristobulus managed to escape from Jerusalem. He was not killed by Pompey. He managed to escape. And he left the bounds of the of this area of the Near East and went into the exile, you might say, in the Parthian Empire. And so now Pompey has control of Jerusalem, but as I say, he doesn't want to stretch Roman resources too thin, and he begins to reevaluate Hyrcanus and decides, okay, Hyrcanus may not be all that swift, but this guy Antipater is a pretty shrewd dude. Maybe in combination, this twosome will work. And so he says, okay, I will authorize Hyrcanus to resume the position as high priest. And we won't let him call himself king, though. He can call himself ethnarch, with the promise that if he does a good job on behalf of Rome, he shows how he can come through. He can cut the mustard. After a few years, we'll authorize him to call himself king. Sort of like the carrot hanging out there in front of him, you know, to show what you can do, and you can call yourself king again in the future. But again, notice what is happening here. It's not just a dispute over who's going to run a country. A Roman general is deciding. It's also deciding who's going to be high priest of Judea. And again, this is now in the hands of a non-Jew, and a decision is being made strictly on political reasons. The high priest has been reduced again to just being a political football, controlled by the ruling power of the area. And so that explains why Hyrcanus becomes high priest and ethnarch in the year 63. Now, you'll notice that there's a change in his status, in 58 B.C. In 58 B.C., he loses the title of ethnarch and is reduced to just being high priest. And if you, as hard as you look on that chart, you can't find anybody else who has it, you see. What happened here is that in the year 58 B.C., there was a rebellion in Galilee, starting in Galilee and spreading to other parts of the country against the rule of Hyrcanus and Herod Antipater. Now, what happened is exactly this type of situation is what the Romans hoped to avoid. And this is something we have to keep very much in the front of our minds. The Romans wanted one thing primarily from all the places they either ruled directly or they had this kind of associated relationship with. Order. Peace, order, stability. That was the bottom line as far as Rome was concerned. If local government authorities could deliver that, great, they stayed in charge. If local authorities couldn't deliver that, they were out on their ear, and Rome would intervene directly. In other words, these people were no use to Rome if they couldn't deliver peace, order, stability. And this is exactly what Hyrcanus had failed to deliver. When the rebellions broke out in Galilee, spreading to other parts of the country, this was something the Romans could not tolerate, and so they removed him from any political influence whatsoever in Judea. Now, since they viewed the high priesthood as simply a religious office, they didn't remove him from that. There was no one else to choose anyway. Aristobulus was still in exile in Parthia. And so there is Hyrcanus only high priest from 58 to 47. The country was actually, and this is not an important point, I'll just mention it in passing, the country was actually divided up into five sections, totally autonomous sections, each one ruled by a council made up of secular nobles primarily, who, you know, handled things within the area, subject to the approval of the Roman governor of Syria, who was preeminently in charge. When we come down to the year 47 BC, we notice that there is a change, however. In 47, Hyrcanus gets a promotion. He is restored as ethnarch. What happened here? What happened here is that Julius Caesar ended up in an extended conflict with Pompey for control of the Roman Empire. I call it an empire because that's what it was. It may have been a republican form of government, but Rome, of course, had an empire to rule. Julius Caesar and Pompey squared off against each other and were fighting in various parts of the Roman world for control of the entire Roman world. What happened is that Pompey had ended up in Egypt trying to escape from Julius Caesar and was treacherously murdered by the Egyptian leadership, hoping to curry favor with Caesar. It was a bad move. Caesar wasn't impressed. Anyway, Julius Caesar came down here, and although he wasn't impressed with the Roman leadership, he was rather captivated by one member of the leadership. Yes. Femme fatale. Cleopatra. She just sort of batted her eyelashes at him, and he might have been a great conqueror, but he also had a heart, and so he succumbed rather rapidly. However, this is a little bit later, his dallying with Cleopatra. He was very, very angry because of this very treacherous murder of Pompey. Pompey had been welcomed, at least on the face, by the Egyptians, and then, just assassinated, you might say. And he felt that he may have been my enemy, but Pompey deserved better treatment than that. And he was beginning to threaten the Egyptians with massive retaliation because of what they had done to Pompey. And Julius Caesar found himself about ready to square off against the Egyptians militarily. And he was very short of men and supplies for this engagement. He had summoned reinforcements from Syria, which of course had to pass through Judea, the coastal plain region of Judea, in order to reach him. Unfortunately, the Egyptians had gotten the city of Gaza to prevent the Roman relief column from getting through. And the Roman relief column was stalled at Gaza. They couldn't get past. Coming down the Via Maris, they were stuck there. And if that relief column didn't get to Egypt, Julius Caesar was finished, because he could not prevail against the numerical superiority of the Egyptians. This is where Antipater sensed a great opportunity. He propped up Hyrcanus on a horse. I don't know if he tied him on or what, but he got him on horseback in front of a Judean army. Remember, they still had, mercenary soldiers at their disposal, and gathered up loads of foodstuffs and other supplies that Julius Caesar badly needed, and marched them off in the direction of Gaza and helped the Roman relief column get through that bottleneck by intervening on the side of the Roman relief column. And as the relief column sped on towards Egypt, Hyrcanus continued on his journey there with Antipater by his side. And of course, once Caesar sorted things out, it was relayed to him what a crucial role Hyrcanus had played in saving his skin. In gratitude, Julius Caesar appointed Hyrcanus ethnarch of Judea, restoring a united Judea under his control. And actually, from this gratitude, a lot of other interesting things later flowed, affecting the Jews generally. When Julius Caesar returned to Rome in triumph and became dictator of the Roman state, one of the things he did was to pass a law that gave Jews the right of worship anywhere in the empire, regardless of what the local population might think. They had the freedom to construct synagogues and worship as they pleased. They didn't need local licensing, in other words. He also passed a law that said that Jews, without any interference from Roman government authorities, may transfer money from any place where they live to Jerusalem, if it's for use as a donation to the temple. So they had unique rights of transferring money if it was for religious purposes in Judea. And another thing, two things he granted, which were very well received by the Jews, was exemption from all military service. This was something the Jews living in the other provinces of the empire found very difficult, is they were conscripted into the auxiliary military, but of course would not fight or bear arms on the Sabbath. And of course they would not want to participate in religious ceremonies that the troops engaged in, because they were pagan. This caused a lot of friction with their neighbors. And so they were given this exemption. They did not have to participate in military service at all. And they were given one more very valuable privilege. They were granted exemption from court appearances on any Sabbath or holy day. In other words, if they had a court case and the court summoned the case for a Sabbath or for a holy day, all they had to do was let the court know this is one of our holy days and the case would be postponed. So as I say, he gave a lot of very valuable benefits to the Jews, largely out of appreciation for this very significant saving of his skin. Yes. Well, Gaza controls that portion of the Via Maris. If they don't let a convoy pass, they can't get past. The people of Gaza. The troops of Gaza, yeah. In other words, they had acceded to the Egyptian request to act on their behalf, and they were preventing the Roman relief column from getting through. Yeah.
Is there a natural way of situation where they can't get through?
It'd be very difficult. Remember, you've got wagons and other, carrying lots of supplies and so on. You can't just go off into the sand dunes. You know, you've got to stay on the road. You're pretty much limited that way. And so, as I said, Hyrcanus did, Antipater was shrewd enough to sense an opportunity and to act decisively to do something about it. Okay. From 47 to 40 B.C., Hyrcanus rules as ethnarch. Now, what happens here is that in this period of time, Herod the Great managed to get himself into a great deal of trouble. Part of the reward that Julius Caesar had given is, you see, Julius Caesar was no dummy. He knew that Hyrcanus was not his deliverer, you know, that Antipater was the real genius behind him. And so while he gave him, Hyrcanus, the title of ethnarch, he gave real power to Antipater and Antipater's sons. Antipater was recognized as the governor of Idumea, which was considered a subsection of Judea. Herod the Great was made the governor of Galilee. And another of Herod's, one of Herod's brothers was made, so to speak, the governor of Jerusalem, responsible for the security of Jerusalem. Now, Hyrcanus, as I said, was a very proud man. Sure, he had the title, but it began to eat at him that though he had the title, he was really a figurehead, and the essential power was in the hands of Antipater and his sons. And it began to eat on him, eat on him, eat on him. What made it worse is that the Pharisees didn't like it either. Because although the family of Antipater was religiously Jewish, ethnically they were Edomite. And they resented the family, this Edomite family, having such power over Judea. So this is what's sort of growing and grumbling its way towards fruition between 47 and 40. It comes to a head when Herod, up there in Galilee, gets wind of another rebellion about to take place in Galilee. And he, of course, knows what the Romans expect. They expect, bottom line, you maintain order and stability. And so he acts very quickly to nip this rebellion in the bud before it gets off the ground. He seizes the ringleaders, and after a summary trial, which we could hardly call a trial at all, more like a kangaroo court, he has them executed. Now, that was very swift, decisive action designed to please the Romans. This swift, decisive action, however, did not please Hyrcanus or the Jewish leadership. They were very upset that he had not observed all due legal procedures. And so Herod the Great was summoned to Jerusalem to stand trial for his excessive action. Herod the Great, sensing that he didn't have much of a chance, that the deck was stacked against him, so to speak, and that he would certainly be found guilty and executed, decided that he would not show up, and he fled the country to Syria. I'm not finishing. Oh, well. I had hoped. He fled the country to Syria, where he found refuge with the governor there, who was a close friend, of course, of Julius Caesar, and therefore owed him at least a couple of favors, you know, being who he was. Eventually, Herod the Great made his way to Rome and became sort of attached to the family of Julius Caesar, which meant also his adopted son, Octavian. Now, I think you know enough about general Roman history to know that Julius Caesar was assassinated in 45 BC. That Octavian was in the forefront of punishing those assassins, and that following his victory, Octavian was in position to return favors for friends such as Herod the Great. But what precipitated a great desire to return the favor was not just personal association, but something that happened in 40 BC. In 40 BC, the Parthian Empire invaded Judea, bringing along a son of Aristobulus II, whose name was Antigonus. And they installed him as their puppet ruler over Judea, giving him the title of high priest and king. I mean, the Parthians figured, if the Romans can use puppets in Judea, we can too. You know, what's the big deal? Now, Herod the Great came to Octavian and said, look, I've got a deal for you. You get the Senate to name me king of Judea. And I will go out and, using my own money, hire myself soldiers and fight to take it over. If I lose, what do you lose? Nothing. You've invested no money. You've invested no troops. I go off on my own. I'm the only thing that's lost. But if I win, Judea will be back in your sphere of influence, you see. And I will be your ally in that part of the world. And this made sense to Octavian. I mean, this was a very cheap deal from the Roman point of view. They were risking nothing and stood to gain quite a lot. And so, at Octavian's urging, the Roman Senate appointed Herod the Great in 40 BC as king of Judea. And Herod then went east, and with borrowed money, he raised himself his troops, engaged Antigonus in battle, defeating and killing him, and thus securing possession of Judea in 37 BC. So though he was named in 40 by the Roman Senate, it took a while to get the money together and get the troops raised, the supplies, march into Judea, and take it back from Antigonus. So in 37 BC, Herod the Great is now physically in charge of Judea, recognized by the Roman state as the proper king of Judea. To somewhat legitimize his hold on the throne, he marries a daughter of the Hasmonean family, whose name is Mariamne, as you see there on the chart. And we will leave the story at that particular juncture. Okay, I did manage to squeeze it in. Therein lies a very interesting story, which we will defer to not next time, but the time thereafter. Because I want to sneak in that thing on Darius the Mede. Because it's one of the big problems that Herod had to face. Who does he use as high priest? Choose the wrong person, he's got a rival power figure, you see.